For those of you who've been here a longer time, I saw David Harris and his wife in January, and they seem to be doing well down in Dartmoor, where they're enjoying their retirement. Every time I come to Christ Church, it changes, expands a little bit, and I see you're expanding further. It must be very exciting to be here. You've asked me to speak about, does the church have anything helpful to say about sexual ethics in the 21st century? Nick Clegg, that well-known social ethicist, once boasted that in his younger days he'd slept with 30 women. And as a politician, he wouldn't have done this unless he thought it would make him sound appealing and attractive. And it certainly plays well in the current climate. But many clergy, and probably some here, can more than match that. They could confidently assert that they have slept with a woman, meaning more than passing the night with her, 3,000 or even 4,000 times. And trumping Nick Clegg's boast further, they could say that the same woman never got bored with their performance or dumped them for someone else. In fact, how do we know that in reality, Nick Clegg's experience actually is evidence that no woman could stand Nick Clegg for a night more than once? What is the difference between Nick Clegg's claim and sleeping with the same woman thousands of times? Or the same man, if you're a woman. The first difference is that wonderful chemical, oxytocin. This is a substance released inside a woman during lovemaking that binds her to her partner and, more wonderfully, blinds her to his faults. So let's hear it for oxytocin. What this means is that sex between people is like Velcro. It binds people together, and if you try and pull it apart, it pulls a little bit off, or a lot off, what it's been bound to. It means that sex between people changes something, and indeed has meaning. It means you only for me, for life, and that we take responsibility for any children conceived. In Christian terms, sex means a commitment, a promise, a covenant, an undertaking for keeps. Now, if people have sex without such a commitment, then one of two things is happening. They're either creating false expectations or even lying to each other. Mr. Clegg probably had no intention of staying with any one of those 30 women, but perhaps some of them had their hopes. Or, if this is really only friendship with benefits, then they're using something that means everything to mean little more than a handshake or a moi, moi on the cheek. Well, you might argue that as long as people are aware of those things, does it matter what meaning people ascribe to sex? As long as people enjoy it, as long as it expresses a current feeling of love and does no harm, what is the difference? Well, there is a difference in the brain. The human brain lays down pathways. It's the basis of addiction, whereby certain pathways are created and they call for stimulation. And as the pathways are used, we need even greater stimulation to get the same kick. It's what alcoholism is based on. It's what pornographic addiction is based on. Now, the adult brain does not mature till 25. Car insurance people know this. And the people who set driving tests also know it, as was in the news this week, calling for the driving test to be postponed till people are 18. Similarly, sex creates bonding and addiction. And we are meant to be addicted to our spouses. We're meant to be. But if we lay down these pathways with 30 women, or 30 men, if you're a woman, then memories and sexual responses are formed which may never be eradicated. So you know the cameo in a film where two people are engaged in sex and one of them cries out the name of a former lover. Creates all hell. There's a reason for that. There's a difference in the brain. There's also a difference for health. And I'm sorry that we've just had breakfast, but I got some rather disturbing figures for you. The incidence of sexually transmitted diseases, STIs, among young women is at epidemic proportions. Premature sexual intercourse for young women is a cause of cervical cancer. And calculated properly, the incidence of HIV/AIDS among young men between 18 and 25 who have sex with men is 1,000 times more than in the heterosexual population. Now, as adolescents, we learn what is wonderfully pleasant long before we learn how to evaluate the risks that come with it. So when our Prime Minister said that young boys who are gay can see that their love is worth the same as anybody else's love, during the passage of the same-sex marriage bill, he was kicking up stones in a minefield. If he thought gay marriage law would be good news to adolescent gay males, he clearly doesn't understand adolescence. I'll say more about that later, but if you want to read further on this, there's a book called God, Gays and the Church. It's on sale at the back for £5 and goes into a lot of material about the experience of people, both lesbian and male homosexual, and their experience of change as well as the biblical teaching. A few more figures on sexual health in the UK. They serve, in my view, to show that Christian teaching of no sexual intercourse before marriage and no sex outside marriage is the wisest counsel health-wise and economic-wise. Here goes. The average age of first intercourse in this country is 16. It's called a sexual debut. Apparently, 30% of teenagers initially have sex before they're 18, before they're 16. In the UK, sexually transmitted diseases are at a record level, with new diagnoses at 500,000 a year. And among females, two-thirds of those are among girls between 15 and 24. Taking gonorrhea, there were 20,000 cases in 2011, a rise of 25% on 2010. 57% of new infections occur in people under 25. Peak age of diagnosis among women is 18. And it's expected that this will increase because drug-resistant strains are now coming, and there'll be a massive increase in this over the next 5 years. The most common bacterial STI is chlamydia. 65% of new diagnoses are in women between 16 and 24 years old. Untreated, they are the main causes of female infertility and ectopic pregnancies. Syphilis has risen 600% in the last 10 years. Virus infections are incurable and may lay undetected, but can be passed on to others. There were 120,756 known cases of HIV in the UK by the end of 2011, with an estimated further 30% of cases undiagnosed. There's a time lag of 6 months before a test will show positive, so the individual may already be infectious before diagnosis is made. Without retroviral treatment, the incidence would have increased by a further 65%. Among young people between 1981 and 2011, there have been 2,340 cases of HIV diagnosed under 15 years old. 2,560 between 16 and 19. Men who have sex with men are 50 times more likely to contract HIV, AIDS, syphilis, or gonorrhea. Although the total numbers of homosexuals and heterosexuals with AIDS are similar, homosexuals are only 1.5% of the population. So that's how you get the risk factor of 1,000 times more likely to contract AIDS. Even when treated, AIDS reduces life expectation by 20 years. This increased risk may be due to various factors, risky lifestyle, alcohol, drugs, promiscuity, but the major factor is that you're not supposed to have it that way because we're not made that way. Same-sex attraction is quite common in adolescents. In fact, 25% of adolescents experience it, while only 1.5% of the population identifies as homosexual, according to the Office of National Statistics. STIs are linked with cancer in the mouth, cervix, anus, prostate, liver, lymphoma, and skin. And there's no such thing as safe sex. Since no condom is 100% secure, and 85% of 85% of 85% of 85% eventually reduces to nothing. These are important statistics. There's a difference also when it comes to children. All the statistics show that intact biological families provide the gold standard for the well-being of children. And the best evidence to date shows that there are clearly differences in outcome from different family structures, and that the intact biological family does significantly better than all other family structures. And this is the problem with same-sex marriage, because it revolutionizes the concept of family for everyone, not just those gays and lesbians who would like to be married. Because it privileges, same-sex marriage privileges, adult needs and desires, and leads to the intentional, socially sanctioned deprivation of children of either their biological father or their biological mother, and new cultural norms which deny the claims of biology for all children. This will lead to further family fragmentation. And as we know, the family fragmentation at the moment costs the Exchequer £46 billion a year. A bit more on economics. The economics of HIV/AIDS. HIV treatment in the UK costs £18,000 a year for each patient. With over 120,000 cases currently, the annual treatment cost is £216 million. The estimated total annual cost of treatment and care for HIV is £858 million. Over one lifetime, because the treatment works, the cost will be £320,000 per individual. So if we save someone from getting HIV/AIDS, by saying, just say no, we save £320,000 per person. The national cost to treat just the current cases will be around, you know, throughout their lifetimes, will be £360 billion, which makes HS2 look cheap. But there are over 6,000 cases every year, new cases every year in the UK. So you add to 360 billion, 6,000 times 18,000 times 20 or 30. So there are health reasons and there are economic reasons for the Christian teaching on sex. What is to be done? The younger generation under 30 doesn't understand what the fuss is about male-female marriage. They've been schooled by pressure groups to believe that love in relationships is all that matters. And they're very vulnerable to re-education by lobby groups who, by suggesting that homophobic bullying is rife, have gained entry to schools to teach young people in primary and secondary about same-sex behaviour and its normality and acceptability. But the fact is that in the area of bullying, bullying for reasons of same-sex issues accounts for only 6% of all bullying. So it's the issue of bullying that needs to be addressed, not the re-education of the population over issues of sex in order to counter supposedly homophobic bullying, which is a made-up word anyway. Now, two things need to be understood and taught. First, that we are created beings responsible for the use of our bodies to the one who created us. The Bible teaches that our bodies are temples wherein God may dwell by his Spirit. That physical union in marriage between a man and a woman is a picture of the relationship between Jesus and his people, and so conveys divine truth. This elevates sex to something far more grand and wonderful. The Bible teaches that we will give account to God for what we have done in our bodies and with our bodies. So any suggestion that what we do with our bodies is irrelevant to ultimate issues or to our ability to carry out public responsibility is a denial of our created status. Secondly, matters of the heart and love are constantly urged as having priority in this field. As long as people love each other, we're told, it's no business of anyone else how they engage sexually or with whom. But sex has consequences. It creates bonds. Remember oxytocin. You can actually buy it at the chemist's. It creates families. It was for hardness of heart that the Old Testament law made allowance for the fact that sometimes those relationships of love do not last. And therefore, the Old Testament made provision for the ending of a marriage union that was meant to be lifelong. But what Jesus came to teach and share was that although provision was made for divorce, this was not to be the norm. That the norm was still lifelong marriage. And Jesus came to make possible that people could be renewed in their hearts, that they could be given patience and forbearance and forgiveness and understanding and inexhaustible supplies of it. This is profoundly necessary for and has a profound effect on marriage. And Jesus made clear that women were of equal status with men. Christian matrimony is so called because it's made up of two Latin words, mater munium. Munium means fortress or defense. Mater means mother. So matrimony is the defense of the mother, the protection of the mother. Marriage is designed to enable women to secure the commitment of the father of their child to stand by them and the child. And the Judeo-Christian tradition is specific in its honouring of women and its dignifying of home and family life and calling men to responsible fatherhood after the pattern of God, from whom the Bible tells us every family on heaven and in earth is named. Now this is a high and a hard calling for men. Jesus does not call people, however, to follow him without also promising the power of his Spirit to enable and support and provide for people in this commitment. Now Christians do not impose this morality on anyone. We do, however, claim the right to speak up for it and to share what has been shown over millennia to be the most fruitful relationship between the sexes and the generations in a mother-father family of exclusive sexual faithfulness for life. And the problem is that the recent law makes no provision for the rights of conscience and the rights of religious belief to voice that in public. None. So I commend Christian marriage to you, and I'm very happy to engage with you in discussion. And I'd be very happy to take a range of comments, responses, questions. And the way I like to do it is by having four or five responses and questions from the floor, and then responding to that as a group, and then moving on. It means that we don't get just tracked down one particular rabbit hole, but we're able to gather a group of responses, etc. So,
I'm happy to wait if there's anybody else. I found your statistics interesting and not surprising. I think that they're quite focused on young people. And I think that one of the things that has been happening in society, which goes relatively unnoticed, is the rise of sexually transmitted diseases in women over between sort of 45 and 55. And I think that's very much symptomatic of a society where, you know, marriage is broken down. And I think it's also an area where the church should have some comment, because, you know, like it or not, there are actually quite a lot of women who would fit into that bracket within the churches, and we need to be, you know, making sure we're kind of helping older people to deal with the issue of sexuality and what to do if you're single, as well as young people.
Thank you. Any other questions, responses? There's one over there.
This isn't a fully formed question, but I'm just trying to put what you've said into practice. If you're talking to a gay couple, you know, a couple of guys who have been married for a while, and they say to you, "Well, you know, you're Christian. You know, why are Christians? Why don't Christians accept we're going to be the way we are?" I mean, I couldn't imagine just reeling off a load of statistics to them and that convincing them in any way. How can we equip ourselves for that situation?
Okay, that's fine. Yeah, thank you. I think there's one back there, or at the end of that table.
I think my question was very similar to that. It's that I can see how the medical and health arguments work at the society level, but if you have one same-sex couple who are faithful throughout their whole life together, then that those medical and health arguments don't seem as powerful.
Okay. One there.
Yeah, my comment would be a little bit like the lady over there's, and that is around the sort of issues, challenges that people face perhaps when they reach retirement, and the kind of pressure and tests that that puts on a relationship, where you probably begin to find out for the first time, and maybe you know how much you really do like one another or like doing things together.
For better, for worse, but not for lunch. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I give a little comment. My wife made a comment to me when we had our little granddaughter for a long weekend some months back, and I felt pretty knackered by Saturday evening. I made a comment that I don't remember our children ever being as demanding as she said, "No, darling, you were always working all the time." You were never around. But it's just what you go through at that phase in life.
Yes, my comment is somewhat similar. It's that while I agree with all the general arguments, if you know people who have got what appears to be a good relationship and they are different, and you do want to get alongside them and be friends with them, even if you disagree with their viewpoint. And it's the practical working out on a day-to-day basis what you do with people who have different views but appear to be making it work. And even with adoption, I mean, sometimes gay couples appear to adopt a child who otherwise would not be have such a good life. It's quite difficult to judge those people as individuals.
Is it going fine? Hi.
Along the same vein of couples who are established and happy with one another, maybe married, wanting to be in a Christian community and part of a church, how do we accommodate that?
In the front here.
In scriptural terms, do you think we should be viewing sexual sin as different from other sin? And if we do view it differently, what do you see as the implication of that for us as Christians?
Pretty good. Okay, I think that's probably... Okay. We'll come to a second round, I think, if that's okay. Okay. You asked about the question of people in their mature years, sort of in 40s and 50s. I got a very good friend who's a GP, and every Monday morning, he's a Christian GP, now retired, but he said every Monday morning he didn't really look forward to his surgery because he knew there would be at least one woman in there who would come to him and say that she was very depressed and she was very upset because over the weekend she'd met this old friend and they'd suddenly found themselves in bed together, etc. I know another GP who we had a meeting a week or so ago with a bishop and was saying, you know, it's got to the stage that, you know, people come to him for counselling as to whether they should have an affair, whether they should have an affair. Because it would sort of spice up life a bit. This is not my field of expertise. I mean, I'm not qualified in this area. I think I would say that we have a responsibility to young people. Young people are at risk because their brains are not fully formed and they're testing everything out, and we want to give them guidance. People in their mature years, in one sense, are old enough to look after themselves and should know. I think we should be supportive, and I think part of the problem that we have at the moment is because the church basically funked the issue in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And you did not get teaching from the pulpit on this matter. Why? Because the clergy were scared. Why were they scared? They were scared because... they knew that sitting in front of them were some rather well-heeled members of the congregation who were living in rather dodgy circumstances and who would make it very clear that if they said anything that made them feel embarrassed, then they and their cash would leave. I've had that from clergy. And that is why we're in the situation we're in. Because we have not been taught the biblical and the social and medical reasons. We were just told, sit 6 inches apart at the youth meeting and don't. Correct? Correct. And it was not from the pulpit. And it should be from the pulpit. And it should be from the scriptures. And I have tried to, in presenting to you, give the reasoned arguments why the scriptures are right. It's not just that, as Geoffrey John says, there are 7 terror texts. It is that the whole scripture is about the healthful and wholesomeness of male-female marriage in every department of life, and there are very good reasons for it, which we continue to find out. So, yes, I agree with you that no one's going to be finally convinced by a series of national statistics. But I think it is reasonable to tell people the risk factors. That there is a risk factor, there's a health risk factor. There's an impact on the national economy factor. When it comes to people who say that they are living faithful same-sex relationships, we have to recognize very properly that many people are in the churches in this situation. We have to give them pastoral support. We have to understand them, that they're no better and no worse than anybody else who lives a sinful, disobedient life. But we have to be very clear that this is sinful disobedience. Let's transfer the argument a bit. What happens if you were to say, look, I know some lovely, charming, hospitable, generous, greedy bankers who have brought down not one bank, but three. You know, what would people say about that? That is sin. And the Bible very clearly teaches that same-sex behavior, not orientation, behavior, is sin against God, who made our bodies in a particular way. One of the reasons why I found myself, which I didn't want to, engaging on this issue, because I employed over a period of time at least three gay men. And one of them said to me, who's now married with two children, he said, please do not stop telling people that there is a way out of this, because otherwise you're condemning people like me to a lifetime in a prison, that there's no way I can change. And it's very important to know that people can be assisted to change. Because what has happened is that they have got inured into certain pathways, as I said, the brain sets down pathways, which over continual practice, they get the sense that this is how they are and how they always have been and how they always have to be. But it is not true. It is not true. And also, on examination, you will find that what is happening is a change of language is taking place. So people will say, yes, they are faithful to one another over 25 years. And by that they mean they are emotionally faithful. But physically, they will be having other relationships. And the evidence is that intact marriages survive by sexual exclusivity. Intact same-sex partnerships survive by promiscuous sexual activity. That is just a statistical fact. So people who say that they have a long-term relationship with another partner, that does not mean it's an exclusive physical relationship. That is statistical fact. And the reason why I've quoted you statistics is because it is not good enough or enough in the current climate to say the Bible teaches that we should honour male-female marriage in exclusive sexual relationships. People say, well, you know, that's the Bible, that's your belief, you know, I think something else. That's why I quoted you a lot of social and economic statistics that show the risk factors and the cost that we are supporting, every one of us with our taxes, of those who have determined not to follow that. Yes, retirement. I married you for better, for worse, and not for lunch. It is a new experience. You're quite right, as you've said. You asked about adopting, and therefore, you know, we should be giving support and encouragement to marriage throughout people's lives, and not just when they're, you know, courting and preparing for weddings, but throughout people's lives. And there are courses. There is an Alpha Marriage course, I think, that helps people, you know, to talk through these sorts of issues. You talked about adoption. This is a very serious issue. It does deprive a child of what it has a right to, which is to have a father and a mother. And it is a study by Mark Regnerus, recent study, has shown that in those families where there is no father and mother, on all counts, children do worse. So it is not the case that it is as good as or even better than normal marriage parenting. May I just add something that is, I think, quite important to understand what is going on in our country? I was at a meeting in the House of Commons, addressed by Peter Tatchell, at the beginning of the year. And his argument was this. The reason why people with same-sex attraction are depressed, have illness, sometimes take their own lives, want to change even from that, is because there is a societal norm of heterosexual marriage which they believe excludes them. And therefore, the societal norm has to be changed and has to be eradicated so that all marriage is genderless. That means that none of us is married in the traditional, normal sense, according to those who have promulgated this law. And it was Peter Tatchell's boast that he was who wrote David Cameron's speech at the Conservative Party conference in 2010, where he said it's because he's a conservative that he's in favour of same-sex marriage. The terrifying thing about David Cameron is he now wants to export this to other parts of the world, which he said after the law was passed, and use the leverage of British foreign aid on countries to change their laws in this regard. He said that at the Commonwealth Conference, that British aid would be tied to this. This is outrageous. This is outrageous. Colonialism lives in Downing Street. It is appalling. I think we need to be aware of what is going on and the damage that this will... The country won't fall apart tomorrow morning. People, sir, who will pay the price will be your grandchildren, because they won't know who they are, and they won't know what they're for. The country will face serious, serious problems in 25 years. Sorry to be so gloomy on a Saturday morning when you're just recovering from a week's hard work, but that's what the situation is. Other questions? There was one here, ma'am, that you wanted to. And I'm very happy to stop. When somebody blows the final whistle, I'm very happy to stop.
I think you actually answered it when you said... I was focusing on the fact that 25% of adolescents...
experience some form.
Yes, and sort of how to help them then. But I think what you're actually saying is we have to be very clear about what's
right and what's wrong.
Yes.
Yes.
And that's the only way to help our young people.
That's right.
Be loving and whatever, but there is right and wrong.
Exactly. And we've just passed through a very dangerous week in the year. Freshers' Week at university. One of our former church warden at church actually said to me a couple of weeks ago, he says, well, we have our children till they're 18 and we can tell them, and by and large we can guide what they do. Then they go off to university and we have no control whatsoever. And it's appalling what they're exposed to and what they're expected to get and what the sort of the norms are. You know, and there are people out there whose aim is to sleep with the whole boat club in the first week or something like that. Absolutely public about it. I had the Oxford Student newspaper just flicking through it last night, and that was, you know, if on a rating, you know, a fail, pass, a third, a second, and a first. And a second was if you slept with the whole boat club in the first week of university. You know, this is the sort of norm of what's going on. And in our schools, it's even worse. The sort of sexual experimentation. I mean, one of my colleagues works as a school chaplain. She says it's horrifying, the pressure put on young people in this area. We don't know half of it. And so, yes, you're quite right. It's to teach people to say, this is right, this is wrong. Go back upstairs, put something decent on before you go out. I've had daughters too.
Hi, you've talked about the importance of data and statistics, totally agree. Can you just expand a little bit? You've mentioned the ONS, some of the other sources of the data that you've quoted.
Yes, very if you go onto a website called Gay Marriage No Thanks, and you click on an advert that we placed in the Times newspaper in June, which the Times accepted, you'll find a whole number of links there to websites. On the Anglican Mainstream website, which I commend to you, www.anglican-mainstream.net, there's a series of three booklets. One is the experience of people who have changed from same-sex behaviour. The other is a response to the Royal College of Psychology and its evidence that it gave to the government and the Church of England on the psychological aspects of same-sex behaviour, which was just plain lies. And this book exposes the lies. This book has been sent to them, asking them for a response. No response has been had. We'll soon publish a response on the website that we'll make to the Advertising Standards Authority, because the Advertising Standards Authority had two complaints about the advert that we put in the Times in June, two complaints, and they will publish their findings, and when they publish their findings, we'll publish the 25 pages of evidence that we put to them. Now, interestingly, you'll have read in the papers about the Advertising Standards Authority's response to that van that was driving around telling people to go home. I think they had something like 200 complaints. Not one of them was upheld. For our advert, passed by the Times, which is a campaigner for same-sex marriage, you'll be well aware, they had two complaints. They have not yet responded to us, even though our advert predated the van's appearance. Something's up. So watch Anglican Mainstream and Gay Marriage No Thanks, but it's all there. I mean, it's all evidence-based, and I can give you some of the evidence in papers here, which I've got. Our intention is to provide evidence why Christian teaching is healthful and wholesome. There's one back there. Oh, sorry. Yes, hello. So
I just wanted to make a comment, which I think ties up quite a lot of things you've been saying, to do with 25 years, the next generation, neural pathways, addictive behaviour. And it's this that I actually work in healthcare. I run a health centre in a boarding school. And this is a subject that's very, very close to my heart. And I spend a lot of time immersed in a way in the sexual activities of young people, for better or for worse. But one of the things that absolutely terrifies me, and it's something that I've only in the last couple of years begun to realise, and I suspect most people here are just only beginning to realise, is the effect of pornography on heterosexual relationships in 25 years' time. Channel 4 has been running a series of programmes on this. It's been in the press recently. But I know from my own experience that this is going to be an explosion or against marriage because of the addictive nature on young brains of seeing images and neural pathways being created. And I know from what I experience, just that this is something that we've never experienced before. And I don't know if people aren't aware of that, then we need to be praying, we need to be doing something, because I think it's the biggest threat to marriage.
Well, one's already read cases of girls who really have been treated as porn stars by their boyfriends, because that's what the boyfriends think it's
normal.
About.
And this is considered absolutely normal. Exactly. The point in young people's sexual relationships is that it's changed, in that I don't know if this is shocking to people, but the expectations is exactly as you say, and that's not extreme, that's not an unusual statistic, that is mainstream, and you know, practices that are taking place would be quite shocking to a lot of people if they didn't realize, and that's a call to prayer
indeed. Well, we should pray for you in your work. You're at the front line. You're absolutely on the front line. There's one at the back.
So my question is, agreeing with your biblical stance and the facts of how it affects us as a culture and, you know, economically and various things, as a believing Christian who is concern for the salvation of those that I love, that are in this lifestyle. I am concerned that because we believe the Bible to be true, and we have statistics and situations that give us good reason to see that in a cultural sense too, that we don't become too self-righteous in our judgment. And part of my concern is, being a heterosexual, I don't have this experience. And it's very hard for me to look at somebody who does and tell them what to think or what to do or how to behave, because this is what the Bible says and this is what the effects on society are. Because for me, it's not an issue. I'm not fighting that urge. I'm not lonely. I'm not alone. I'm not. I have children. I have a long marriage, and so I get that I'm not coming from the same place. And although we can be confident in what the Bible says, and obviously this situations and statistics that are saying that actually, there's good reason for what it says. Relationally,
what do you do?
We want them to be, we know we all have problems, we all have issues, yes. We know the answer to that. We want to point them to Christ. How did we do that without rejecting? It's a hard
very
question.
Good. That's a very good question and very well framed. And of course, there is an answer to that that many people put, and many people in evangelical churches put, which is that what we want to do is bring people to Christ, and then Christ will sort out their problems. And that let Christ be the one who brings light into darkness, let Christ be the one who shows them the true way, etc. And that we shouldn't put people off Jesus because of supposedly judgmental attitudes we have. Now, I've got a couple of responses to that. The first is, if we look at the way Jesus engaged in evangelism and sharing the good news of the kingdom in the Gospels, he didn't try to convince people he was nice in order for them then to follow him, and then, he would begin to address their lives. He made very clear, the kingdom of God has come, repent and believe the good news. That was a very clear challenge right up front as to what life in the kingdom was about. He spelt it out very clearly. Secondly, we are living in a victim culture, and everybody is a victim. So the way you defend yourself against any criticism is that you say, well, it's the four Yorkshiremen joke of Monty Python, Well, my dad got up and he strapped us before breakfast, and then we didn't have any breakfast and we had to go out. We didn't even have a bed to sleep in, and we had to have rats for breakfast, etc. So what people do is that they live in a worse dustbin than you. And I've been in Christian conferences internationally and all around the world, and this is regularly played out, a victim culture. Jesus didn't come to make us victims. Jesus came in order that we could be victors over sin and evil. And so we don't do well by playing into the victim culture or giving in to their narrative. So my sense is, I would say back to your problem, which is a real problem, how would you deal with a greedy banker who just brought about the collapse, of families' mortgages and put people on the dole and everything because of their unrestricted greed? Would you say, I can't be judgmental, I have to understand your need for three yachts in the Mediterranean and a private jet? No, you wouldn't. But I think it is the same, because this is about disobedience to God. It is the same. And that's my answer to your question, sir. It is actually, Paul says, this is a sin against your body. Every other sin is outside the body. This is a sin against the body God gave you. So I think we've got to say, what attitude would we take to another approach? And you could say, we could be judgmental about paedophiles. You wait. Paedophiles are going to be out. And they will say, what's wrong? with minor attractiveness. You know, if the children like it and we like it, don't judge us. That's how we are. You'll find the same arguments come out for paedophiles. You'll find the same arguments come out for polygamy. They're just waiting. So I think we've got to be very careful on this emotional blackmail that is used against us, because that's what it is. And I think we've got to realise two things about people who behave in this way. One is that part of their behaviour is narcissism. What matters is their pleasure, beginning and end. And secondly, there are no boundaries. Whatever gives them pleasure in any way is okay. That's what we're dealing with. And we know that in life that doesn't work. That is selfishness. So we have to understand, we have to change the narrative. They've got a very well thought through narrative. It was on display in the House of Commons and the House of Lords in the same-sex marriage debates. You know, these are lovely people, I've got lovely friends, how could you deny love, we want to celebrate it, etc. It was huge emotional blackmail and very clever PR. But it is blackmail. And we've got to change the narrative. Say, no, that's not the way it is. If we have a look, A, at the evidence of this behaviour, that's why I've given you the statistics. This behaviour on a macro scale is like this. Please look at that, please understand that. And secondly, this behaviour is ultimately selfish, because already, we, you know, the argument has been, well, let's have gay marriage in order that there's stability in the relationships. Well, a story in the papers this week is already the first civil partnerships have ended in divorce. The seven-year itch has already taken place. They're no different. So it's not going to produce any greater stability. David Cameron has been had for a sucker, in my view.
It's not really a question. I cried the day the Church of Scotland said they would remarry divorced people, because my husband's wonderful, but I was struggling in my marriage, and I felt that the church that I had been born and baptised into had let me down. And I was a Christian, and I wanted the church to support me. And I think that the church must continue to say that what is sin and wrong, to support the people in the church who are looking for support from the church to live a godly life. And when the church is more interested in those outside the church than their members inside who are struggling and need the support. So God bless you and keep doing what you're doing.
Well, maybe that'd be a good time to round up, to say thank you very much to those who made this morning possible, and especially to Chris. Chris has got a few minutes before his train goes now, so if you've not managed to catch him through the question time, do grab him afterwards. But let's just finish by saying thank you very much to Chris for this morning.
Thank you. I'm not running away. The bookstall is at the back. I don't have to get off exceedingly quickly, so very happy to engage in conversation afterwards. We have a network, we have a group in Anglican Mainstream called the Marriage, Sex and Culture Group, which is a support group of those people who are engaged in this, either as counsellors, school chaplains, therapists, and if you'd like to know more about that, do have a word with me. It's a mutual support group. We meet every term and pass around papers and telephone support, etc., because these are the people on the front line who are dealing with this. Thank you.